Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Welcome. Thanks for coming. I'm Jesse. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University, way up here on Burnaby Mountain, where we broadcast from the unceded ancestral territory of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples, who have been here since time immemorial. Today on the program, I have a whole bunch of stuff to share with you. I did two interviews with Dr. T.L. Phelps Bondaroff about two separate topics. One, an update on the sea cucumber crime story that I presented earlier this year, as the perpetrator in one of the cases we talked about has been sentenced. And one about the launch of a new campaign to try to save the National PharmaCare program, which the Liberal government has signaled it is less interested than before in pursuing. And then I had the chance to attend yesterday a press release of the initial results of the 2025 Greater Vancouver Homelessness Count. And so I'll share a recording of that press conference and those two interviews and a piece from Danny, a re-edited version of his interview about a Culture Quest app in North Vancouver as well. Well, we'll see what else happens. And we are going to start, as we always do, with some local music. And we're going back to the artist that is topping the charts here at CJSF for the last week. It's our very own Yawn and this track, The World Is Burning.
Waiting, anticipating, oh, the precious building. Kinda got the feeling like I've got a new lease on the life I'm leading. Where I just abandon everything I'm feeling, and as it gets darker, I don't have to see it. I can close the curtains, choose not to believe it. Everybody's laughing, we're having such a good time. Everybody's dancing, we don't read the headlines. 'Cause the world is slowly burning. I can't help this earthly yearning. Throw your hands up on my body for the chance to just feel something good coming. Oh, I'm driving down the highway crying. Hear the collective sighs of people passing by me. We all want a new start to find a new beginning. Gotta medicate. Flame.
good coming.
World is Burning by Yon from the new record Wish I Could've, which is topping the CJSF charts right now. I'm Jesse. This is Speak Up. And let's get right into my first talk piece of the day, which is about a new campaign from Access BC, which is the nonprofit that successfully campaigned to have free prescription contraception for all folks in BC, and is now expanding that campaign to try to make it a nationwide situation, service. And we talk about the National PharmaCare Plan that was passed by the previous Liberal government, and Mark Carney recently announced that his government would no longer be actively pursuing agreements with the provinces. We get into the details, but as healthcare is a provincial responsibility, provinces get to decide what happens. And Phelps Bondaroff argues that the federal government should be doing more to pursue this. I'll let Teal lay it all out for you with this interview.
I'm Teal Phelps Bondaroff. I'm the chair and co-founder of Access BC. We are a grassroots campaign that successfully fought for free prescription contraception in British Columbia. And now that that policy has been rolled out, we are working to expand the policy across the country and to support the expansion of the policy here in British Columbia.
Teal, thanks for joining me. Why is free access to prescription contraception important?
This is a transformative policy. So when you invest in free prescription contraception, you improve health outcomes, you make life more affordable, you make life more equal, and you save governments money. We know that cost is a significant barrier, making it harder for people to access prescription contraception. And we actually had a huge headline story this week from the University of British Columbia showing just how impactful free prescription contraception can be. So a hormonal IUD, one of the most reliable forms of contraception, is also one of the most expensive. They cost around $500. And that's a lot of money. There's a study from Stats Canada that was done a little while back that found that around 25% of Canadians don't have the money on hand to afford an unexpected expense of $500 or more. So we know that cost is a barrier. And the research that just came out of the University of British Columbia, published in the British Medical Journal this week, found that after British Columbia made prescription contraception free, there was a 49% increase in LARC dispensation. LARCs are long-acting reversible contraceptives, so IUDs and implants. So what that shows us is that when cost is removed as a barrier, people increasingly reach for more reliable forms of contraception, and they have. So that's been very validating. And ultimately, our campaign is about removing those barriers that people face when trying to access life-saving and life-changing medicine. And British Columbia has been great. We've been very successful. So British Columbia became the first jurisdiction in Canada to make prescription contraception free in April 2023. Since that time, over 306,000 people have availed themselves of free prescription contraception, and the policy has been transformative. In addition to those numbers from UBC, there's some other studies that came from those same researchers from a seminar earlier this year where they're reporting a 10% increase overall in people using prescription contraception in general, and that's been absolutely fantastic news. And ultimately, this is about reproductive autonomy, right? Someone's ability to exercise reproductive autonomy and access life-saving medicine should never depend on their income. And fortunately, British Columbia has been a huge leader on this, and it's been great to see the very positive results.
This policy has been, as you said, very successful in British Columbia. You mentioned some numbers and the more quantitative impacts. How impactful would you say access to free contraception has been here in BC?
It's enormous, right? So not only do we have people using prescription contraception to prevent unplanned pregnancy or to time their births, but I think a lot of people, especially men, often forget that prescription contraception is prescribed for a wide range of reasons. Often chronic gynecological conditions like PMDD and PCOS and endometriosis, for hormonal acne, for menstrual regulation, for preventing against some forms of cancer, and for gender-affirming care. So there's a whole wide range of reasons why you might be prescribed prescription contraception by your doctor. And those are all valid, and they're all reasons why the medication should be free. And it's also worth underscoring a bunch of other points, too. Like, one of them is that, you know, when it comes to contraception, we want to have people to have choice, Not everyone's bodies are the same. Not everyone's lifestyles are the same. You want someone to have a range of options that can accommodate whatever is going on in their life. And when you make prescription contraception free, it allows people to explore and experiment with the type that works best with their body. And what we've seen from this recent research at the University of British Columbia is that it also means that people are able to access more reliable forms of contraception like IUDs, which is fantastic news. One other bit of interesting information was that before prescription contraception was made free here in British Columbia, 37% of people were paying out of pocket for prescription contraception. That number is now down to 13%, or it was in June 2024. And that's really significant. A lot of people may have coverage through work or through their school or through their parents, but they're still paying out of pocket. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is privacy. If you're on your parents' plan, you may not want to tell your parents you're using prescription contraception, and so people pay out of pocket. And the other reason is because a lot of people who are using prescription contraception to prevent against unplanned pregnancy are younger folks, and the only contraception, the only prescription they may be buying that year is prescription contraception, and as a result, they don't hit their deductibles, so they're still paying out of pocket. And so it's still a barrier for people. I will say that cost is not the only barrier preventing people from accessing contraception. So our campaign, now that we have the policy set up here in British Columbia, we'll be launching a new campaign this fall focused on improving pain management for IUD insertions. So we want to remove additional barriers. There's direct cost, there's indirect cost, it's having to travel distances, especially in rural and remote communities, the need to take time off work or school, the need for childcare, those are all additional indirect costs. But then you also have stigma and taboo and misinformation and disinformation. And on top of that, the need for effective pain management for some of the procedures. So we'll be launching that campaign this fall, and we're hoping to urge the government to improve some of their processes to make it easier for people to access pain management. And that's been really good news. And we're hoping to see this policy roll out across the country. So what we've been working on now that the policy has been adopted here in British Columbia, in addition to working to expand it here, has been to spread it across Canada. And we had a lot of initial success. Manitoba became the second province to adopt free contraception last fall. And Bill C-64 was adopted by the federal government prior to the last federal election. Bill C-64 is the National Pharmacare Plan, and that's the plan that proposes free prescription contraception and free diabetes medicine and supplies across the country. That was adopted, and the next step was that the federal government needed to enter into negotiations with each of the provinces to finalize how much money was being exchanged, etc. Manitoba was the first province to sign on, followed by BC. These provinces both already had the policy in place. I'm sure the communication and the conversation negotiations was a little bit easier. PEI signed on, and then Yukon will be implementing the policy before the end of the year. And then the federal election hit. And our hope was that following the federal election, the federal government would step up and follow through on negotiating agreements with the remaining provinces. Unfortunately, this week, we've just heard from the Carney government that they have no intention of negotiating new agreements. So only 17% of Canadians, those in BC, Manitoba, PEI, and Yukon, are going to be able to enjoy the National Pharmacare Plan. Not much of a National Pharmacare Plan now, is it now? And the rest of folks won't. Now, there's nothing stopping provinces from implementing this policy on their own. It is a fantastic policy. It is revenue positive. It saves governments money. So any province could do what Manitoba and BC did, which was to step up and implement the policy tomorrow, and they should. But the fact that the federal government is effectively stepping away from further negotiations, to me, underscores it's very devastating to a national pharmacare plan. Our hope was that they would start with contraception and diabetes medicine and supplies, and then implement the next stage, which was rare diseases, and then keep going, because you shouldn't have to reach for your wallet when it comes to accessing life-saving medicine. And your ability to, you go to the doctor for free, but you can't pay for your prescription, that's a problem. So we're hoping to rectify that. But it seems that the Carney government is signaling the opposite, that they're kind of abandoning the National Pharmacare Plan. And they'll maintain the agreements that are in place, but they're not going to be negotiating new ones. And that is terrible news and a massive disappointment.
Right. And so for folks who are interested, who believe in pharmacare and a national pharmacare plan, who want to take some sort of action on this, what is Access BC doing?
Yeah, just yesterday we launched a national letter writing campaign to send letters to the Prime Minister, and it'll also copy in people's Member of Parliament. If you're interested in signing up, folks who are listening, that's at accessbc.org. And it takes a few seconds to send a letter. There are those form letter things. You can, of course, add your own experiences, but it only takes a few seconds. And our hope is to really flood the Prime Minister's inbox with emails. My hope is that the news that we heard this week was the federal Liberals sort of testing the waters as to whether backing away from pharmacare was going to be acceptable to Canadians. So we need to send a very powerful message that it is not okay. And I hope that if we send that message and we send that message in mass, that we'll see the government hopefully backpedaling and ideally negotiating more agreements with the provinces. But this isn't the only bad news we've had around gender equality this month. The other news we've heard was that the Carney government's looking for 15% cuts in departments across the board, except the Department of Women and Gender Equality, which is getting an 80% cut to their budget for 2028. That's also devastating news. So you're starting to pile on disappointing failures when it comes to gender equality with the new Carney government, and I'm very alarmed by that. The other news that we heard was a $1 billion cut to Health Canada funding, looking forward to 2028. And that's, again, really bad news. So it seems that we have a federal government that's thoroughly distracted by international trade and tariff issues and is throwing Canadians under the bus and leaving people in very dire situations where they can't access life-saving and life-changing medicine and undermining gender equality, and that's not okay.
Nationalized healthcare, free healthcare in Canada is a big part of the Canadian identity. It's a big part of the way Canadians think about themselves and differentiate themselves from particularly Americans. What is your sort of read on how Canadians feel about the federal pharmacare program and the Liberal government's current attitude towards that?
Yeah, great point. And yes, absolutely. Reproductive justice, gender equality, and healthcare are core Canadian values. And so to me, it seems a little bit ironic when we have a federal government trying to juxtapose Canadian values against American values, where, by the way, the United States was proposing burning, was it $10 million of contraception that was destined for foreign aid that's, you know, being, you know, stored in a warehouse somewhere in Europe. So if you're trying to juxtapose your values against the horrific fascist Trump regime, then you should do a better job, in my opinion, as far as with the federal government doing. So I think that's really important. And when you ask Canadians what they think about free prescription contraception, they overwhelmingly support the policy. The polls that were done a couple years back showed like well over 80% of people support this, with good reason, right? Like, the policy, again, it improves health outcomes, it makes life more affordable, it makes life more equal, and it saves governments money. I think that's something I want to really underscore here. We're talking about preventative medicine, and we have a Carney government that's really set on tightening budgets. But this is a time to invest in preventative medicine. A study from Dr. Wendy Norman from the Contraception and Abortion Research Team at the University of British Columbia estimated that free prescription contraception is going to save British Columbia around $27 million a year. There was an older study from 2015 published in the Canadian Association of Medical Journal that estimated that the policy would save Canada around $320 million a year. And that's just in the direct costs associated with unplanned pregnancy. So this is something that we should definitely be investing in. And when it comes to pharmacare, like, more broadly, not just free prescription contraception, that argument still holds out, right? Like, we want happy, healthy people able to live their best lives. And the idea of having, you know, free public health care, but then not being able to actually fill the prescription your doctor gives me seems just absolutely off the wall to me. It's all about trying to keep people happy and healthy. And when you invest in these programs, they work. And that's what we're seeing from not just the research that's hot off the press from UBC, but research, reams of research going back decades.
It's interesting that, you know, the aphorism, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is rooted in medicine and yet seems to be being ignored, or at least sort of pushed to the wayside.
Absolutely. And I mean, my big worry here is this ongoing trend of the Carney government really not taking gender equality and reproductive health issues all that seriously. And that's really worrying. I think a lot of people, well, I'm not sure what a lot of people were thinking when they put the Carney government and they voted for the Carney government, but I don't think this is what they thought they'd get. I don't think people were expecting neoliberal austerity cuts savaging their way across fundamental and core Canadian policies. And I mean, this is a huge disappointment, particularly around pharmacare, because here's a government that literally started this policy. The bill was passed, negotiations were beginning. We have some provinces that are a bit more reluctant to adopt the policy. I'm looking at you, Alberta. I'm looking at you, Ontario. Maybe Saskatchewan. Not sure what most think in these days. But then we also have some provinces that were exploring doing the policy. Premier Holt in New Brunswick, it was in her platform when she was elected as the new premier of New Brunswick, and their government is working on the policy. They're just taking a bit longer than we might like. And I've heard similar rumblings from Newfoundland and Labrador, right? Those are two provinces that could be getting on board with this policy if the federal government was negotiating with any level of enthusiasm. What we need at this point around pharmacare is a federal government that's going to show actual leadership and step up and work with the outstanding provinces to adopt this important policy, not one that's going to back away. But unfortunately, what we're hearing from the Carney government is they're backing away, and that's really not okay.
All right. So if listeners want to get involved with the PharmaCare Shouldn't Depend on Your Postal Code letter writing campaign, how can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So people can head over to accessbc.org. It takes a few seconds to send a letter. We're asking folks to share that with their friends. If you're hearing this story, please tell your friends about it. It's a really short notice letter writing campaign, and it's important. We really need to signal to the federal government that they need to follow through on their promises and that your ability to access life-saving and life-changing medicine should not depend on your income or where you live.
All right. Well, thanks, Teal, for taking the time to talk about this really important issue.
Always a pleasure chatting with you, and I hope you're having a great day.
Yeah, likewise. Take care. If you are interested in supporting the PharmaCare Shouldn't Depend on Your Postal Code campaign, once again, you can go to accessbc.org. It's a big red button that says write a letter now, and it'll walk you through the whole thing. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Be right back.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.
Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're just going to get right into the next story, which is my recording of a press release about the 2025 Greater Vancouver Homelessness Count Preliminary Report, which was presented at the Luma Housing Society and Medical Center in East Vancouver, and includes all sorts of important information and, not great news, but important news to be aware of, including that overall homelessness has increased by 9% since the last time the homelessness count was done, and that homelessness is increasing in surrounding communities outside of Vancouver itself. So here in Burnaby, New Westminster, all the way up to Langley, from Langley to West Vancouver. And that the biggest increases have been in unsheltered homelessness, so folks who are living on the street outside of a shelter. So important information to take in and think about and start to brainstorm solutions from a government and policy perspective. So I'm just going to drop us right into the beginning of that press conference.
So you get sick of the hana? Cool, sick? I'd like to thank you for coming today and bearing witness to our preliminary homelessness report. And we have our chairs for the Indigenous Homelessness Steering Committee, David Wells, here, and the chair for the Greater Vancouver Homelessness Steering Committee, Lorraine Copas, is also here, and they will walk you through the results of our report. This is a preliminary report, and the full report will be coming out in September. So thank you for coming.
Hello, I'm Lorraine Copas. I'm the chair of the designated Reaching Home Community Advisory Board. My role today is to walk you through the numbers and to talk a bit about what some of the numbers mean. David will speak to the really important piece around Indigenous homelessness here in the region and how much that factors into the whole homeless count. I also think it was really important that we start the meeting the way we did today in the healing space within Luma's medical center here. Doing it that way, I hope, makes us understand that each of these numbers are real people and that their stories are tragic. And there's so much happening in society today that homelessness is an issue that we have to get ahead of, because so many lives are ruined if you don't have a home. The homeless count numbers show that the numbers are up again, and they're up by about 9% over the last count, and the last count wasn't done that long ago, so you start to see a very disturbing pattern and trend. When you look at the report itself, those numbers start to show up on page 6 of the report, that the last time the count was done in 2023, there were 4,821 people. who had lived experience of homelessness, who were either staying in an emergency shelter or living on the streets or in encampments. Today, 2025, the numbers are 5,232. Before I go much further, I also think it's really important to recognize all the community partners and volunteers who came out to do this count. Everything from the Homelessness Services Association, who is a steadfast frontline organization that works with all the emergency shelters here in BC, to 483 volunteers who really wanted to make sure that people's stories were heard and that we really understood what was happening. Page 7 of the report talks about the street homeless or the sheltered homeless versus the unsheltered homelessness. And again, you can see that the sheltered homelessness total still comprises the largest percent of those who were identified in the homeless count, 3,339 people. And that this is slightly better than the previous count, but it doesn't mean that there are fewer people homeless. It might mean that certain shelter beds closed or certain other things changed. So we have every reason to believe that when you look at the net increase, two troubling factors. The change in sheltered homelessness is hard to understand fully, but the increase in street homelessness is where the increase is coming from, and that's heartbreaking. The rest of the report, and I won't go through it in detail, but I do ask that you look at it and really look at the numbers and think of the people and the stories behind these numbers. Talk about different regional changes, and what you'll see is it used to be a large urban center problem, and now you see homelessness across the entire region, and the like growth spikes in homelessness across the entire region, and that this is troubling because some of the other communities don't have the same types of services, supports, and infrastructure that you need. For me, I often look at the demographics, and this will be where I'll finish my conversation, and David will pick up some of the important conversation about the demographics. So I look at how many youth are experiencing homelessness, and are we going in the right direction? How many seniors are experiencing homelessness? And what are we doing around people who are working age, who, if given the chance, could really connect back into their lives and move forward? And so on page 11, you'll see that this count, there were 172 youth who were without a place to live, and we know that youth is a hidden homelessness number, that they're often couch surfing and doing other things, so they don't necessarily show up in this count. We know that there were 2,171 working-age adults who were without a place to live, and we know that there were 677 seniors. And I actually asked the count team to pull me one data point that I've been tracking. And that's the question of how many seniors, so seniors in our case is 55 and older, used to be eligible for social housing, how many seniors were new to homelessness? And the number that came back was 47%. So that means the first time that they experienced homelessness was in their older age. And that says to me again some of the troubling dynamics behind these numbers that we really have to understand and work to get ahead. I think I'll leave to David to speak to the gender piece and also the important piece around Indigenous.
Thanks, Lorraine. David Wells, I'm the chair of the Metro Vancouver Indigenous Homelessness Steering Committee. I'm going to focus on a couple of key things, as Lorraine mentioned, some of the data. Obviously, we're looking at the big report that comes in the fall. That's where we'll get some really detailed information if we're looking for it. We know that in past counts, Indigenous homelessness has accounted for about a third or more of the overall homelessness count, and that's been consistent over the past several counts. And so we'll be looking to see those specific numbers. Maybe what's more troubling, and Lorraine pointed to this within the report, is the entire increase is really in unsheltered homelessness. And that stands out. The actual raw numbers for sheltered homelessness dropped by about 21, count 21, which is less than a percent. So that means that entire 400 to 500 additional count of homelessness is unsheltered. It tells us a couple things. Certainly we know that in terms of the undercount, that's predominant within the unsheltered counts because, as Lorraine mentioned, couch surfing, cars, boats, different locations, and we've seen it over the past several counts where it's getting farther and further afield. And Lorraine mentioned, throughout the Metro Vancouver area, many different cities have unsheltered homelessness, and it's a piece that I think folks see the most frequently, obviously. And so that's one piece. But more importantly to the Indigenous communities is that, unlike non-Indigenous communities, Indigenous homelessness is predominantly unsheltered. other areas, mostly sheltered within the indigenous communities, more folks that are homeless are unsheltered than sheltered.